Good afternoon. This is Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center. Welcome to our monthly conference call. Today we are happy to have Douglas J. Fife with us. Doug Fife is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, where he heads the Center for National Security Strategies. He's also a best-selling New York Times author. He's been a professor of national security studies at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service, at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Prior to that, he served in the Reagan and Bush administrations, and without wanting to make him sound too old, prior to that, he was a managing partner in a Washington, D.C. law firm. He's going to talk to us today on the historical perspective of President Trump's peace plan. I know that when you RSVP'd for this meeting, you were asked if you had questions. Thank you. Many of you did send in questions, but if a question comes to you while we're talking, you can reach us at info@jewishpolicycenter.org. We're watching that board. If you have a question, info@jewishpolicycenter.org. Doug's going to talk to us, and then we will go to questions. Doug, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. The Trump peace plan has commonly been criticized on the grounds that it's not likely to produce a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And the critics cite all kinds of elements of the peace plan that they rightly argue are unacceptable to the leadership of the Palestinian Authority. And they say that demonstrates that the plan is a failure and is doomed to fail because it's unacceptable. I think that criticism of the Trump plan misses the key point of the plan. The plan, I would argue, is premised on the understanding that the leaders of the Palestinian Authority now won't make peace under any circumstances with Israel. And so I don't think it's proper to judge the plan on whether it will produce peace between the current Palestinian leadership and Israel. I don't think it's intended to produce peace between the current Palestinian leadership and Israel. So then, what's the point of the plan? It seems to me that the point is to help reshape the Middle East's political landscape by declaring certain truths and creating certain incentives that may make peace possible down the road. And I think this is an important point also, which is that the plan aims to promote U.S. interests whether or not it produces a Palestinian-Israeli peace deal. It implicitly recognizes that such a deal may not be possible now or ever. And so when you think about the plan, the proper way to judge it is, or at least the proper way to understand how the people in the administration appear to have judged it, is will it advance American interests and our interest in our relationship with Israel, whether or not it produces a deal with the Palestinians? So as I said, it's aiming at declaring certain truths and creating certain incentives. So one major truth that it is declaring, I believe, is that the Oslo process is a failure. And the principal reason for the failure is the bad, one could say rotten, nature of the Palestinian Authority. The plan says, for example, the Trump plan says that the Oslo process did not create an effective path. It says that the Palestinian Authority is plagued by failed institutions and endemic corruption. It says that the Palestinian Authority controlled media and schools promote a culture of incitement. It says that the Palestinian leaders don't recognize Israel as a Jewish state. They don't reject terrorism. And they have been unwilling to choose pragmatic solutions. So the plan is very blunt and harsh in its judgment of the Palestinian Authority. And it's interesting that in contrast to past diplomacy, the Trump plan does not aim to lure the Palestinian leaders into peace and into making concessions by praising them for statesmanship and vision. And it doesn't lavish on them the kind of compliments that, for example, President Clinton and his administration's officials lavished on Arafat after the 1993 Oslo Accords were signed. Arafat was praised to the sky. He was honored in various ways. He became the most invited foreign leader to the White House during the Clinton administration. And it's clear that the Trump administration is bluntly rejecting that approach toward trying to lavish blandishments and praise and rewards on the Palestinian leadership. On the contrary, it's been the plan itself is a serious indictment of the nature of the Palestinian leadership. Now, another major truth that the plan seems to be promoting is that the conflict is not about the so-called final status issues. Again, that's a term that comes out of the Oslo process. The Oslo process was premised on the idea that what the conflict was really about were a bunch of practical problems that could be solved through diplomacy. So the final status issues were things like boundaries and security arrangements and water and Jerusalem and settlements. And the idea behind Oslo was both parties want peace. There are certain practical problems. It's essentially a line drawing problem. And the negotiations are required to draw the line. And through mutual compromise and good faith, the parties will be able to reach a solution. Well, interestingly enough, after decades, it became clear that approach, that diplomatic approach, didn't produce peace. And I think that what the Trump peace plan is saying is that the conflict is not about those final status issues. It's about Arab anti-Zionist ideology. And there are numerous references in the Trump plan to the importance of ending incitement, including in government-controlled media. I'm quoting from the plan right now. As well as an end to the glorification of violence, terrorism, and martyrdom. It calls for prohibiting hostile propaganda, as well as textbooks, curriculum, and related materials contrary to the goal of the Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement, including the denial of one another's right to exist. So there's a very strong emphasis on Arab anti-Zionist ideology in the Trump plan. And one's approach to the diplomatic resolution of the conflict is entirely different if you view the conflict as fundamentally ideological versus a essentially practical problem of resolving things like border and water rights. And what the Trump plan is implying is, since the conflict is fundamentally ideological, the only way it's going to be solved is if the Palestinians have a leadership that has a different ideology, which is to say, a different leadership. It's an entirely different way of looking at the conflict. Now, a third major truth that the plan is promoting is that there's a price to be paid for Palestinian rejectionism. Historically, it's very interesting to look at how much effort has gone into the attempt to try to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict diplomatically over the decades. And U.S. and other foreign diplomats have essentially told the Arabs in general and the Palestinians in particular for years that they should make peace, but if they don't, Israel will be pressured to preserve the status quo by not annexing territory, not building settlements. The U.S., for example, took the position for many years that we won't move our embassy to Jerusalem, even West Jerusalem, until after there's peace. And by saying after there's peace, that means after the Arabs consent. So we basically created a situation where we were delivering the message to Israel's enemies that they could maintain their position of hostility to Israel, and we would do everything we could to freeze the status quo and preserve the options for the Arabs as long as they maintain their rejectionist position. And obviously that creates a bizarre incentive if you want to promote peace. And I would argue that this conceptual problem of saying to the Arabs, we would like you to make peace, but we will make sure that you don't lose any ground at all if you refuse to make peace, that conceptual flaw in many ways is rooted in UN Security Council Resolution 242, which received virtually universal praise when it was adopted, and it's been repeated over the years by American officials, Israeli officials, Arab officials, that this is the Holy Grail, that this is all the key principles of peace are embodied in UN Resolution 242. But UN Resolution 242 has this gigantic conceptual flaw built into it, which is that it basically says aggressors, it says that Israel should withdraw from the territories that it conquered in the recent conflict. And the principle seems to be that aggressors are entitled to get their land back when their aggression fails. And I think that's a really strange concept. It's a concept of international law that was essentially invented in the case of Israel and applied to nobody but Israel. And it creates a really bad incentive. And the Trump plan recognizes that's a bad incentive, and it actually has some very harsh comments about UN resolutions. And so the Trump plan actually conceptually is very iconoclastic. I mean, even willing to take on UN resolutions that have been said to be the foundation for American policy for decades. And the Trump plan says loud and clear that the Palestinians are literally losing ground by refusing to make peace with Israel, that there's a price to be paid for rejectionism, that life goes on with or without the consent of Arafat or Mahmoud Abbas. Now, the Trump plan doesn't use the term regime change, but it's clear that it aims to bring about for the Palestinians a new kind of leadership and new political institutions. It talks, for example, and again, I'll quote phrases from the plan itself. It talks about developing property and contract rights, the rule of law, anti-corruption measures, capital markets, a pro-growth tax structure, and a low tariff scheme with reduced trade barriers. It talks about upholding property rights, improving the legal and regulatory framework for businesses. It talks about a fair and independent judicial branch for the Palestinians, bolstering government transparency and accountability. It says it's very important that education focuses on peace, that there's an end to incitement, et cetera. Now, this sounds like wild and unrealistic talk, but I think the way to understand it is they're basically saying that if you're going to have a proper, if the Palestinians are going to have a proper country, these are the elements of a proper democratic country, a country that could be trusted to have a rule of law, to respect its own domestic laws, and therefore to have a better chance of respecting the international agreements that it makes. And I don't think it's proper to look at it by saying, well, this shows that the Trump administration people are absurdly unrealistic about what you can expect the Palestinians to produce. I think that's the wrong attitude. The right attitude is to say they have defined what a civilized democratic country looks like with some of these concepts. And they're doing it in order to draw the contrast between the Palestinian Authority as it now exists, which doesn't have independent judiciary and doesn't have accountability and doesn't have transparency and has a president who's in, you know, whatever the 15th or so year of a four-year presidential term, and they don't have elections and they don't have property rights, and it's basically a corrupt tyranny. And they're saying it's unrealistic to expect a corrupt tyranny like this to be trusted by Israel or anybody else to uphold its international agreements and to be able to make good use, for example, of international aid. And the last point I want to make in these opening remarks is that the Trump plan, in effect, having made these very severe comments about the Palestinian Authority, then turns and encourages a much larger role in the issue of peace with Israel, a much larger role for the Arab states in the region. And the final point that I want to make is to review some history about this issue of how important in the Arab-Israeli conflict are the Palestinians and their leaders versus the Arab states and their leaders. So here, a quick review of some history. The Arab-Jewish fight over Palestine was mainly in the decades after World War I, in the Palestine Mandate period. It was mainly a local dispute between Jews and Arabs in Palestine. Main Palestinian leader, the dominant figure for decades after World War I, was the famous Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, a man named Haj Amin al-Husseini. Now, Haj Amin al-Husseini, he was appointed Grand Mufti by the British when the British ran the Mandate Administration for Palestine. And he, in World War II, supported Germany. And first he tried to engineer a pro-Nazi coup in Iraq against the British influence in Iraq. And when the British suppressed that coup in Baghdad, Haj Amin fled to Berlin and spent the rest of the war as a guest of Hitler in Berlin. And so Haj Amin discredited himself with the Allied powers by his association with the Nazis. And he was discredited even in the eyes of the anti-Zionists in the British government. So nobody wanted to have anything, none of the Allies wanted to have anything to do with the the leadership of the Palestinians after World War II because of their association with the Nazis. So then you have the founding of the Arab League in 1945, and the Arab League at the time comprised the several Arab states that existed. And the Arab states, through the Arab League, took up the anti-Zionist cause. I mean, the purpose of the Arab League was basically to promote the idea of Arab nationalism and Arab unity. And it turns out that they couldn't agree on very much. And one of the few things they could agree on was anti-Zionism. So the main focus of the Arab League, beginning in 1945, became anti-Zionism. And they became the main players in diplomacy against the Jews and then later the Israelis. Now, the Palestinian Arabs effectively disappeared as players on the world stage as a result. And it's, you can see that in the fact that the UN resolutions regarding Palestine in the 1947 to 49 period, for example, made no mention of the Palestinians as such. They spoke only of Arabs and of refugees. Even as late as 1967, UN resolutions made no mention of the Palestinians. The UN Resolution 242, which I talked about before, does not talk about the Palestinians. It talks about refugees. 22 years, in other words, in 1967, which was 22 years after World War II, the Palestinians were still paying the price of their leader having discredited himself and his people in the eyes of the Allies. So the conflict, which had been known in the 20s and 30s as the Palestine problem, from the 40s forward became known as the Arab-Israeli conflict. And it was only after Arafat took over the PLO in 1969, and then the 1973 Yom Kippur War and the so-called oil embargo occurred, that the Palestinians regained a more or less autonomous voice for themselves in world affairs. And it's interesting that from the 1970s forward, the conflict once again made reference to the Palestinians. And most people now refer to the conflict as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But then came the 1993 Oslo Accords, which greatly elevated the status of Arafat and the PLO. And what we've seen is over the next 25 years after the 1993 Oslo Accords, the Palestinian Authority leadership, I would argue, has discredited itself again. And you see that in, for example, the Palestinian Authority was unable to maintain unity even in the areas that it controlled. So there was a split between the PLO and Hamas. And so the Palestinian Authority now controls only the parts of the West Bank, but doesn't control Gaza. And you then have, as the Trump peace plan points out, the incitements to violence, terrorism, corruption, the Palestinian Authority's ties to Iran, its support for Saddam Hussein. And all of that has so discredited the Palestinian leadership that the Trump administration is basically trying to recreate the situation that occurred after World War II, which is they're trying to turn what has been referred to in recent decades as the Palestinian-Israeli conflict back into the Arab-Israeli conflict. And they're trying to turn it into the Arab-Israeli conflict because the Arab states now, first of all, you have Egypt and Jordan already have peace treaties with Israel. And the Gulf Arab states, the Saudis and the Emiratis and others, are more willing to reach out and have contacts with Israel and view Israel not just as an enemy, but as an ally in their most important foreign policy problem, which is the threat from Iran. And so what the Trump administration people are doing is they're saying, if we can broaden our view of the conflict so that it's not a Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but an Arab-Israeli conflict, then we may be able to capitalize on the Arab states' current focus on the Iranian threat and build on the willingness of Arab states to have contacts with Israel and cultivate more relations with Israel and give the Arab states more of a voice than they have had in recent decades, which is a way of changing the landscape for the Palestinians. And the Arab states can have an influence on Palestinian politics in that could possibly turn out to produce a new kind of leadership that might make peace possible. But the basic thinking is, even if it doesn't make peace possible, it advances American interests to encourage a greater role of countries like Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and others, a greater role in dealing with Israel than happened in the past, and to take away from the Palestinian Authority essentially a veto over how close relations can be between Israel and its Arab neighbors. Anyway, with that, I'll stop, and we can get into questions and discussion.
Excuse me. Thank you, Doug. We have questions. The first one is a combination of questions. It's actually three. Does the rollout of this plan in an election year mean it has to be mothballed until after November anyhow? The second part of that question is, are the Palestinians hoping that they'll get a better deal if Trump loses in November? And third, if Trump is not reelected in November, would our new president have the right, the ability to take back things that the Trump administration has done, relocating the embassy, maybe removing recognition of the Golan as part of Israel, perhaps restating that Jewish settlement in Judea and Samaria is illegal? So can you answer the U.S. election related questions?
Okay. Well, I certainly think that the Palestinian Authority leaders are conscious that they could have friendlier officials in Washington if Trump loses. So I think the answer to that question is yes, and they do think that they could. When you say a better deal, I agree with the Trump administration. What I believe is the Trump administration position, that you're not going to get a peace deal with this Palestinian leadership. What they're looking for is not a better deal. They're looking for better relations with the United States, despite the absence of a deal. And they would certainly have better relations with a better chance of better relations with the United States if Trump loses. Now, can the new U.S. Could a new U.S. administration, if Trump loses, roll back things that Trump has done? I mean, the answer is yes. You'd have to go item by item to see what can be rolled back. But that doesn't mean that what Trump has done gets totally negated. So, for example, on the embassy, it's not impossible for a future administration to roll back the embassy point. My sense is it would be very hard to do. It would be very expensive. It would be politically costly. If I had to bet, I would bet that that's not going to be a high priority thing for an administration under a president that was not happy with what Trump did on Jerusalem. I think is unlikely to invest the political capital and the financial cost of stopping the construction of the embassy in Jerusalem and moving back to Tel Aviv. So that I think Trump has set that up in a way that the costs would be high to move it back. they could cert. I mean, anything that's in the nature of a declaration, like, you know, we declare that we recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan, a future administration could say, you know, we don't agree with that and we don't recognize it. But the fact, I mean, the fact that a U.S. administration has recognized it changes the political reality in Israel. It makes it much less likely, for example, that a future Israeli government would feel enormous American pressure to withdraw from the Golan. I think that what Trump has done doesn't create absolutely irreversible realities, but it does change the politics of the situation. And the last point I'll make on that is on the issue of the legality of the settlements, which is one of the more significant, I think, Trump administration declarations. What I think is significant about what the Trump administration has said on the legality of the settlements is that for many years since the Carter administration, opponents of Israel's settlements have been able to say that there's an international consensus of which the United States is a part, that the settlements are illegal. And what the Trump administration has now done with its very strong statement on, you know, the settlements are not illegal, is they haven't prevented a future U.S. administration from going back to the old position, but they can no longer say that there is this consensus in the world. Now you have one administration says they're not illegal. Another administration says they are. It makes it much more like it's a fight among international lawyers. And so that breaks the idea that there's this monolithic consensus that what the Israelis are doing in building settlements in the territories is illegal. And breaking that monolithic consensus is a significant thing. That cannot be repaired. That's like Humpty Dumpty. You can't put it back together again. And if they convert the issue of the legality of the settlement simply into a fight among lawyers about international law, that changes the nature of the fight.
Thank you. There is a question about Palestinian leadership. You have mentioned that Abbas is in the 16th year of his 4-year term. He's also 84 years old. He's also been treated for cancer. So the questioner says, is there an enlightened leadership in waiting among the Palestinians? And are there behind the scenes indications that we see other people coming forward that we might better be able to work with? Or are we shooting in the dark?
I don't think that the Palestinian Authority has created a bench where good leadership is just waiting to come in and replace Abbas and his team. That's why I said that while the Trump plan does not use the term regime change, it strongly implies that what is required is regime change. In other words, something more extensive than merely the change of leadership at the top. The Palestinian Authority is not going to become the kind of institution that the Trump plan talks about, you know, with an independent judiciary and transparency and accountability and anti-corruption measures and all the rest of it, just because Abbas gets switched out. It's a thoroughly rotten institution. It's totally corrupt. It's built on corruption. It's built on essentially stealing the international aid that comes in from numerous sources and providing it to political cronies. the pay for slay legislation that the Palestinian Authority has, which is it's a formal set of laws and institutions designed to provide rewards to Palestinian terrorists who are imprisoned in Israel by the Israelis, or the families of Palestinian terrorists who were killed. And the amount of payments that are given is provided by law to increase according to the sentences that the Palestinians receive for those terrorist acts, which is to say, it's tied so that the more Israelis who were injured or killed in a terrorist attack, the more money they pay the terrorist. And this is actually laid out in legislation in a formal institutional way. I mean, that's the kind of thing that shows how corruption and violence permeates the Palestinian Authority. So it's changing it to a good leadership requires a lot more than just replacing Mahmoud Abbas. And what's required is a thorough overhaul. And so I think it is important that Abbas is going to die soon, probably because of his illness and his age. But I don't think anybody should expect a radical change for the better when he dies. I think that you need to take a longer view. And I think part of the thinking of Trump administration officials is if they can bring in greater activity from the greater involvement from the Arab neighboring states, and then create the financial incentives through their $50 billion aid package that they're dangling for the Palestinians, and then make better use of Palestinians, for example, in the so-called Palestinian diaspora in Europe and the United States, there's some possibility that perhaps over decades you could get the kind of new leadership and new institutions that the Palestinians need to have a proper government that would understand its interest in peace with Israel.
Thank you. We're going to close with a philosophical question. In the digital age, which seems to promote a kind of societal attention deficit disorder, and postmodernism's cultural relativism, in which factual truth is denigrated as a tool of the ruling class, can history and the texts it's based on be made to matter? And if they can, how can they?
Well, that is an interesting question. My sense is that if you're talking about the academics who are heavily invested in the phenomena that the question highlights, where there's like a denial of truth and the substitution of the idea of narratives for truth in analyzing history, for those academics, the answer is probably no. You can facts don't matter to them, and I'm not sure you can get to first base with any of them talking about history and facts. That's the bad news. The good news is most people are not lunatic academics, and I think for the mass of people, common sense still has some hold, and even in the age of the internet, common sense survives among people in general. And I think the average person with common sense understands that there is such a thing as a fact, and that history does offer some insight and guidance and is important. And so, and I think that the key recognition for people who are interested in U.S.-Israeli relations and support for Israel And the key thing to recognize in this regard, it seems to me, is the main arguments that are used against Israel are moral arguments rooted in history, right? I mean, the main arguments that are made on college campuses, for example, against Israel are extremely simple, morally powerful, and historically rooted. Things like the Jews stole the Arabs' land. And that gets in, you know, the moral concept of theft and the historical questions of, you know, whose land was it? And so the moral judgment is based on a certain understanding of history. The anti-Israel people argue that the land that Israel is on was Arab land. Now, of course, it wasn't when the Turks owned the land for 400 years before World War I, when the British took it in a completely lawful military operation against an enemy. And so it wasn't an Arab country. It wasn't Arab land. And the British took it from the Turks. And I think understanding the history and understanding how things unfolded is crucial to understanding why the essential moral argument that the Jews stole the land from the Arabs is wrong. And so I think that even in the internet age, and even with all the crazy theories people have about history and narratives and this and that, it really is important for people who want to defend Israel and its right to exist and its relationship with the United States to know the history and be able to answer these very simple but very powerful anti-Israel arguments that get made in universities and in news articles and magazines and elsewhere. What I would argue is people who like Israel, friends of Israel, should pay attention to the history and don't use the fact that there's an internet and some lunatic academic theories as an excuse for not mastering the history.
And don't look on Twitter. Doug, on that.
Yeah,
note.
The fact is, the world is full of people who do operate on a basically commonsensical basis. And those are the people that you should be trying to address. And there are people who cannot, as the saying goes, you can't reason somebody out of a position that he didn't reason himself into. And so there are people who have a passionate detestation of Israel that is not rooted in reason. And I wouldn't spend a whole lot of time on them. But there are lots of people in the world that are more open-minded, and it's important for people who support American policy toward Israel, or people who just want to support Israel, to know the history and be able to make the basic arguments and appeal to people for whom reason does matter.
That's why we invited you to talk to the members and friends of the JPC today. So let me thank you for spending your lunch hour enlightening our group. And to the members and friends who are on the line, you will get an invitation to next month's speaker. But also, if you're in Washington, there will be a book and author lunch. The Honorable Tevi Troy has written Fight House, Rivalries in the White House from Truman to Trump. And we will do a book and author lunch in Washington at the end of March and look for your invitation. Doug, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to conclude this phone call.